Welcome back. It's Ruby Tuesday. I'm your host, Patrick Ruby of Sports on Earth. And every Tuesday, we'll be speaking with someone smart about the stuff in sports page that transcends the sports page. This week's guest is Dave Zirin, a man who has been translating the sports page for as long as I can remember. Dave's a sports editor at The Nation, the first ever sports editor at The Nation, a place that's better known for political, cultural news and commentary. He's also the author of many books and the host of Edge of Sports show on Satellite Radio, where I've always had a great time as a guest. Dave, my friend, my fellow radicalized sports writer, welcome to the podcast. How are you?
It's great to be here. Thanks so much for having me. I'm so excited to be on Ruby Tuesdays.
That's right. It's Ruby. There's no her in there. Silent H.
Ruby Tuesday. Cool whip.
All right. So the tagline in your show is where politics and sports collide, or where sports and politics collide, excuse me. And that's what I want to do today. We're going to take sports, we're going to take politics, and we're going to smash them together like Clowney smashing some poor hapless running back from Michigan. So first topic I want to ask you about, the Sochi Olympics. Now, Russia's hosting the Winter Games next year. Russia's also home to some relatively new and totally repressive anti-gay laws, which are not only terrible in their own right, but they also don't really seem to jive with that Olympic theme of, you know, peace, love, brotherhood, and enough HGH to fill an Olympic-sized pool. Just kidding about that last part. Mm-hmm. Or am I? But anyway, we've seen athletes speaking out against this already. And I know that you've written a lot about this, but here's the two things I want to ask you. One, what kind of legal and cultural hostility towards gays in Russia are we actually talking about? And two, what, if anything, can and should the Olympics or Olympic athletes do about this?
Two huge questions, two great questions. I mean, first, the actuality of the laws, because there really has been a lot of misinformation about what these laws are and what these laws do. I mean, what these laws are, in fact, are an effort to criminalize the speaking about LGBT existence in Russia. So it's almost like, imagine Don't Ask, Don't Tell reinforced with prison or beatings. That's basically what it's like. And wow. So Russian officials say, and it's not untrue, hey, no one is saying you can't be gay, but you also can't say to anybody else that you're gay either. And one of the things about the law, which is so insidious, is that it's parsed in such an abstract way that some people have analyzed it and said, if a lawmaker even says, I disagree with these laws, that could be seen as propagating homosexuality and same-sex relationships.
Yeah, I mean, couldn't almost anything be seen as propagating? What if two gay guys are walking down the street and want to hold hands? Is that propagating?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, so that would fall under propagating. And the thing, and from everything I've read about it, is that there's such wide discretion about for that police and law enforcement are allowed to use when they're defining propagating. So that's one part of it. Mm-hmm. The second part of it, which is so critical to the Olympics, is the idea that's enshrined in law that tourists can be arrested, that people who aren't from the country can be arrested if they come to the country to protest these laws, if they come to the country to propagate the LGBT lifestyle. And some people have already been arrested. They can be held up to 2 weeks in a Russian prison if they're seen as propagating. Now, what is propagating? Well, propagating could be, of course, I don't know, going to the Olympics and saying, I disagree with these laws, going to the Olympics and wearing a rainbow glove, going to the Olympics and painting your fingernails rainbow colors. And this is that last example I did actually did happen recently at the World Track and Field Championships in Moscow. And it just tells you how incendiary the situation is that these were two Swedish athletes who they painted their fingernails in rainbow colors. And their Olympic committee said, you better cut that out. Stop it.
Did the Russian authorities
change their fingernails?
Did the Russian authorities crack down on them?
No. And it was their own Olympic committee. And that's a good segue to your other question about what should the International Olympic Committee do. Well, right now they're not doing anything. So something would be a good start. I mean, they've made a couple of very antiseptic statements based on pressure. But there are certain things they haven't done that would be really easy. Like, for example, because of these Russian laws, there's not going to be a Pride House at this year's Olympics. There have been Pride Houses at every Olympics since Vancouver in 2010. So they had them in Vancouver and then in London in 2012. And a Pride House is basically just a resource center on Olympic grounds for LGBT athletes. That's all it is. And let's just say the Olympic Village can be aggressively heterosexual. I'll just, you know, people probably might have read some of those stories.
Right.
So the Pride House is basically a place to get away from just the general vibe at the Olympic Village and to just have a place where you can meet other LGBT people and just hang out. And Russia banned them, prevented them from doing it.
And there's no pushback from the IOC. There's
0.0.
So, you know, some people have gone as far to say we need a boycott. Other people argue, no, show up, compete, and then protest. Like, do something like John Carlos and Tommy Smith famously did with the Black Power salutes on the medal stand in Mexico in 1968. One of our writers, Thomas Rios, actually recently published a piece. He argued that, you know, social change itself is slow and hard, and that Russia already has activists on the ground risking their lives, risking their limb to make that kind of change happen. Obviously, these activists in Russia are now going up against these propagation laws. And so Thomas said, you know, the best thing athletes could do would be to donate just straight cash to these activists. Activists always need cash. They always need financial support. Let me ask you, what do you make of that idea? Do you think it's likely? And is there anything else you think athletes should be doing?
Well, two things. First of all, you can't speak about Olympic athletes like you might speak about baseball, basketball, or football players as uniformly having money. Some do, but many of the Olympic athletes that you see are people whose families like sell their cars and clothes and shoes just to pay for training to get them there. So to look at them as a financial resource, as a totality, just isn't factually on point. The issue, what when you're talking about the question of solidarity, mm-hmm. when you're talking about the question of being an ally, what you want to do is, and this is where Thomas is absolutely correct, what you want to do is something that helps the people who are on the ground when you leave. Like, you don't want to go there, make some big splash, and then leave, and then there are people who actually have to then shoulder the burden of what you did. So that has to be thought through very carefully. So
yeah, that's a great point. I mean, it seems like a really tricky line. If you're an athlete, I want to go there and I want to make some sort of statement. I want to do some sort of protest. But what if all that protest does is, you know, maybe in other parts of the world, people look at that and are like, that's really brave. That's great. Good job. But in Russia, what if people look at that and like, this person is showing up our country and they actually, you know, there's a backlash and they crack down harder.
No, that's a very real consideration, but there's a way around it. And but first, before I say the way around it, it's like, let's remember that Tommy Smith and John Carlos, because they seem to be a constant point of reference when we talk about this, they didn't go to the Mexico City Olympics to protest Mexico. You know, they went there to protest the United States. So they went there, caught hell, and then went home and caught hell. You don't want a situation where you're going over there to catch hell, and then you come home a conquering hero, and then you've left people there to deal with it. So I think the number one thing that people can do is actually, and this is one of the glorious things about social media, is they should try to get in touch with the people. Like, if you're an Olympic athlete and you think, I need to go over there and say something, the starting point does need to be to talk to the people on the ground in Russia. I mean, for example, the person who is going to organize the Sochi Pride House and then got smacked down for doing it is organizing a Sochi Pride March to coincide with day one of the Olympics. It seems to me if they're already organizing a march, one thing you could do is march with them, is go out there with them. Most likely you would probably save them from a police beating or some other form of repression, or maybe not even a police beating, because one of the problems in Russia is a lot of vigilante beatings as well. And it just seems like if athletes are there and a lot of cameras are there, it might actually save people.
Right. They don't want to create an international embarrassing incident of, look at us, we're beating on the Olympic athletes right now.
Yeah. And to be clear, and this is always important for activists to look at where the divisions are in terms of the ruling authorities. there are some divisions inside in Russia right now, because you have some leading members of the Duma, their parliament, who are saying, yeah, if any Olympic athlete comes here and tries anything, they'll be arrested. That's our law. They can't break the law. We will arrest them. And then you have the head, though, of the Russian Olympic Committee, who just says that any idea that we'll arrest athletes is an invention of the West. And it's like an imperial invention as a way to crack down on Russia.
Let me ask you, how divided are people in Russia about these laws? I mean, obviously there are activists working against it, but is there any way to gauge as a whole where the country's at?
Yeah, there are polls, and the polls are dispiriting. I mean, the polls I've seen are anywhere from 79% to 87% support these laws. And I mean, think about that, though. I mean, what do people in the United States agree on 87% as a totality? I mean, it largely does not exist.
There's nothing
here. Like, Martin Luther King was a good person. You know, that'll probably get 82%.
Right.
I mean, so it's scary that there's that much mass support. And that mass support, frankly, helps explain why when the Duma voted on these laws, it was – I might get the count slightly wrong, Patrick, but it was something like 435-0. Like, not – there was one person who abstained, but not one member of the Duma disagreed with these laws. And there have been a lot of sociological discussions, blah, 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 about why there is this kind of support. Like Russia's, like LGBT people used as a scapegoat for Russia's falling birth rate. Like, there is all kinds of existential stuff that's out there. But the fact of the matter is, at the end of the day, it's like we live in a country here, Patrick, where, in the state of Virginia, for example, I think the number was also 87%. Of the state of Virginia was in favor of anti-miscegenation laws, like mixed couples getting married, black and white couples getting married, when the Loving case hit the Supreme Court, and that was overturned, the anti-miscegenation laws.
And that's not that long ago.
No, that's right. That's right. That was about 40 years ago, a little over 40 years ago. So our situation is one where we have a history in this country that we should look at and say, no, you don't just say, well, look at the polls, therefore we can't struggle. It's like that actually makes struggle all the more important, because that's how minds are changed.
Do you think if any athletes go over there and show support, does the example of Olympic athletes, who in general people look at and admire, and what they do is amazing, the way they move is beautiful. I mean, that's a thing where it's pretty, for the most part, it's pretty uncontroversial. Olympic athletes would pull pretty high in terms of people just being predisposed to be favorable to them.
Sure.
If they sort of set this example, and it's not necessarily in a an in-your-face way, but if they just set this good example of support, is that the way they should go about it? Is that what might help shift some attitudes?
Yeah, I think. And remember, the key question is, how do you shift attitudes in Russia?
Right.
That's the key question, because that will actually make things easier for the people when you leave them behind. And once again, it's like the people who can best answer that question are people on the ground in Russia.
Right.
But I have to believe that the more discussion there is – I mean, for example, the fact that because of the pressure and the protest and the struggle, the fact that the head of Russia's Olympic Committee is now – openly defying one of the leaders of the Duma and saying, no, people won't be arrested, that's a step forward. That's something that challenges the status quo and the dominant ideas. So that's a big deal. And so it shows that struggle actually does help, because it brings more ideas into the political oxygen. Mm-hmm. And you want to do it, though, in a way that you can't be pigeonholed as saying, oh, well, this is – the United States, this is really about Edward Snowden. This is really about trade deals. This is really about Syria. And let me be clear about this. There is no doubt in my mind that there are people in U.S. politics, in Washington, who will use the LGBT oppression as a way to ding Russia for Syria or Snowden or trade or any of the things. Because right now the relationship, of course,
it's very strained.
Is deeply, deeply estranged.
Right.
And it's just another arrow in the quiver. And especially because you have a lot of people in the U.S. who are pro-LGBT rights and pro-Snowden, and it's a way to divide people.
Well, this really does point out, too, how people like to keep the politics out of their sports, but you really can't, and especially when it comes to the Olympics. Really quickly, before we get off the Olympics, I want to also ask you about Brazil. The last I saw, people there were royally pissed about how much the government is spending on hosting the 2016 Summer Games. And they're also really pissed about the gap between the haves and the have-nots in the country in general. What's the latest there?
Mm.
What's developed since we saw those big protests earlier this year?
I mean, since the big protest, what you have is a much more fundamentally grassroots project that's going on right now. On the ground, particularly in Rio, you have communities that have organized against displacement. One of the biggest communities that was going to be displaced since the protest, they announced that they would not be displacing people. That was a huge victory. The mayor of Rio, who is a real corporate and Olympic shill, recently made a rather remarkable comment that he didn't understand what the Olympics were for, like a very critical statement about the Olympics, and that's a big deal. And at the top of society, the Workers' Party, you know, meeting in Brasilia in the capital city, they are simultaneously trying to enact reforms that will mollify people, while simultaneously they are stepping up a security apparatus. I mean, it is like carrot and stick. I hate using this expression, Patrick, because it's so cliched, but it is carrot and stick on steroids. Like, Brazil is a very wealthy country, and so they are 200 – a lot of people – that's, I feel like I got to say this, Patrick, because it's like Brazil, 200 million people. I mean, bigger than the continental United States. Like, I really often feel like people in the U.S. don't understand, like, what a sleeping giant, what an economic giant Brazil can and probably will be in the next century.
It is developing into already.
Exactly. Said,
there's a lot of wealth in Brazil. You know, by the way, I just want to clarify a point. When you say communities not being displaced, we're basically talking about slums being bulldozed, right?
Well, they're sometimes known they're known more popularly as the favelas.
Right.
And we're talking about, yeah, like the people having their homes bulldozed, being moved into government housing. And it's worth saying that, you know, Brazil has some, for a lot of historical reasons that I'm not going to, like, bore your listeners with, like, Brazil has some of the strongest squatters' rights laws in the world. Mm-hmm. And so you have people who have lived in the favelas for decades. And over the course of those decades, they have built upon their homes. Now, they own their homes, but they don't own their homes. Like, when I was over there and met them and people were explaining to me how legally they own their homes, but they really only own their homes because they've squatted on them, it reminded me a little bit of people who are taking advantage of the medical marijuana laws in many states. And it's like, it's legal in your state, but federally it's not legal. And if the government ever wanted to, they could step in.
I see. And so it's complicated. This is a complicated, yeah, it's a complicated domestic issue in Brazil. So, well, let's move on to something domestic here in the States. One of my favorite topics, and even does touch on some of the things we're talking about in terms of public spending for sports, mayors speaking out. Of course, I'm talking about sports welfare. You know, basically the American public continuing to give billionaire sports owners hundreds of millions of dollars towards building stadiums. Now, there were two stories last week that caught my eye. I want to run them both past
before you go. Before you go on, now it's like me interviewing you, Patrick, because I think you and Neil DeMouse, of course, do the best work in the country on this. Is it right to say now in 2013 that people keep giving the money? I mean, in the 90s, we were giving the money. But they've really moved away in many places from the referendum strategy, because it is actually unpopular in many places when they talk about this because of some of the bigger crises in schools, hospitals, et cetera, infrastructure. Are you finding that to be the case as well?
Well, it seems like, yeah, I mean, in terms of there being a referendum where the public votes on giving the money, it does seem like we're moving away from that, but only because it's not working anymore. But in terms of the bottom line, the final result, the public ending up paying, that doesn't seem to be changing a lot. And that's what, like I said, two of the stories I saw last week sort of spoke to this. The first one we saw, this is a crazy one. We saw Chris Hansen, you know, the hedge fund manager who was trying to bring the Sacramento Kings to Seattle. He donated $100,000. This is how you were talking about, to a supposed grassroots, quote unquote, anti-arena effort in Sacramento, where the taxpayers are going to cough up something like $260 million in new subsidies to keep the Kings there. And the second story, and yeah, this goes back to you mentioned Neil DeMoss with his Field of Schemes blog, which is essential for following this stuff. He reported how teams like the Falcons and the Pacers, they're receiving these things called stadium operating subsidies that are actually just huge cash payments from the public to the team. The Phoenix Coyotes, this is the worst one I've seen yet, are going to get $15 million a year in quote-unquote arena management fees.
Jesus.
That's coming on top of the $9 million a year the public is already paying in debt payments on the arena they built for the Coyotes.
Arena this, operating subsidies.
Yeah, arena management fees. And guess what? This comes as Glendale, where the stadium is. Glendale has a budget crisis. They're laying off firefighters. They're closing public pools. They're actually talking about selling off their own city hall to help pay for the hockey stadium that they're already in debt over. And now they're going to start giving the Coyotes $15 million a year in management fees to keep them around. Like, we're going broke at every level in this country. Cities, states, federal government. But we're still showering sports teams in cash, whether it's backroom dealings with the city council, like in Charlotte and Jerry Richardson, whether it's the referendums, whether it's what's going on in Sacramento with the Kings. Why, when we're broke, is this still happening?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I really think, I've been asked that a lot. And what I always come back to is that people are desperate for urban spending in this country. People are desperate for anything that looks like, I mean, look at Detroit, for goodness sakes. The same week, the city is declared bankrupt. They announce over $400 million in state money that's going to build the Red Wings a new stadium for
that's
Mike Ilitch.
Yeah, that's the worst
worth
example
almost
of all.
$3 billion. Mike Ilitch could pay for that and be worth $2.5 billion. Boo-hoo.
Sell a few more Little Caesars pizza. I don't understand how... How is this, like you said, how is this happening? And we're just, people still believe the old saw that if you build, if they build it, they will come. If you build an arena, it's going to make the city richer. Because that's been disproven over and over and over again by every economic study.
Yeah, every study has disproven this, every single one. This isn't, I remember, Patrick, I used to get in debates on the radio about this issue, and it was like opinion versus opinion. It's now facts versus fantasy. For people who argue for this stuff, and the fantasy is, God, it's not going anywhere. And once again, it's like if you're asking me about like the mass psychology in a city that would approve it instead of going all Brazil on these stadiums, and I like that as an adjective. I'm going to use that.
They're going Brazil.
Yeah, going Brazil on these stadiums. I mean, I really do think that speaks to the fact that people just want the spending so badly.
Well, I've got another theory, and this isn't really a theory. This comes from – I talked to a guy that used to work with the Minnesota Federal Reserve for a story I wrote a couple of months ago, and he studied this for years. And sure. For years, he's gone around testifying in various cities and municipalities against these kind of stadium plans, bringing all these sort of facts we're talking about to the table, showing all the real economic studies. But the way he described it is this. He said, for instance, if you're Ziggy Wolf and you own the Vikings and you want a new stadium, okay, for a 10-year period, for you to spend $1 million, $2 million a year on lobbying the city council, lobbying the state legislature, waiting for, killjoys like this economist to come through and make their case and then leave town. If you're just willing to wait and spend that money, the end of that 10 years, if you get, eventually you get that legislation passed, because you just wear people down and you're using that money to influence the legislative process, which is how it works everywhere. We live in Washington, so we know all about that.
Sure.
Then, so you've invested what, like 10, 15 million over 10 years, but you're getting like 500 to 600 million stadium on the other end, plus your franchise value is going to go up by at least that amount. It's basically just a great investment.
Right.
And so his theory is just like, the people that would be opposed to this, even if it's widespread public sentiment, they're generally disorganized, they got other things to do. They don't have the same incentive to wait and try and wait and try and keep hitting that rock the way a team owner does. And that's kind of his theory as to why this keeps happening more than anything. These billionaires are so much more highly motivated because the payout is so huge.
Right. And of course, I'm not, it's not surprising that he came up with that from Minnesota when you have Carl Pohlad, who literally spent the last 25 years of his life from ages 72 to 97 having this be his central focus to get the people to build him a stadium, even though he's the richest owner in Major League Baseball for most of that time.
It's just sickening. Look, there's another story that caught my eye that gave me maybe a glimmer of hope down in Orlando, where there are some tentative plans for the public to fork over $55 million towards a new soccer stadium. And get this, in the hopes of landing an MLS team, the county commissioner down there is a guy named Pete Clark. He's proposed that in return, he wants the county to get a share of the team's stadium revenue and also a share of the profits if the team is ever sold. Do you think that in itself is a good idea? Or that it would justify investing so much public money in what's still going to be a privately owned and run business?
Well, I've always believed in looking at these issues. Like when it comes to public stadium funding, it's not like the expression, you can't be a little bit pregnant. You know, you either you are or you aren't. There are definitely greater or lesser evils when it comes to these fundings. I mean, sometimes it may be a question of, are you cutting me off at the ankle, the knee, or the hip? But there are greater or lesser evils. I mean, there are two things that I think people who are advocates, who are public advocates, or sports journalists who see themselves as working in the public interest, I think you really, though, have to take one of two positions, which is either owners should pay for stadiums themselves or that public funding should come with public ownership. I mean, and that's, I think, if you aren't working from that starting point, if you aren't working from that framework, then what you're dealing with is a situation where the people, to a greater or lesser degree, are going to end up getting exploited in this process.
I mean, I'm with you on that. You know, I think we've both written about the idea of public ownership and how, in some ways, that could, if not solve, really alleviate so many of the public abusing practices that we see from sports owners. But is it ever feasible that's going to happen? Like, no, the Dodgers were never going to be a publicly owned team when they were sold. You know, I mean, you've got the Green Bay Packers, but they were grandfathered in. The NFL is never going to allow that to happen again. I mean, is it ever going to even be possible in America that a sports franchise, a major sports franchise, would be publicly owned?
I mean, it would take an actual movement to do it. It would take a legal solution, a political solution, that both of which would end up as the result of mass public pressure. But I really do think that, like, there have been situations in recent years, like the Seattle Supersonics being one example, where if there had been more political will, that could have been pushed forward. And it will take a lot. It's not the sort of thing that will just happen because it's logical. Because as we've seen, logic does not play into these discussions. But if we don't start putting that out there as the goal, then we're never even going to be on the path towards getting there.
Well, what would be, I mean, for people that maybe haven't thought about it, what would be the biggest advantages of a team being publicly owned from the perspective of the public and the perspective of fans? What would be better than having some rich guy like Jerry Jones owning a team?
Well, there are reasons for both from a sports perspective and an economic perspective that show how much better it would be, with Green Bay being, I think, this wonderful object lesson in that. I mean, first and foremost, just from a football perspective, one of the things that guarantees is that, one, your team's not going to move. No one's going to threaten for your team to move. And you're not going to have an owner like a Jerry Jones or a Dan Snyder who believes that, you know, just because they write the checks – they somehow magically know more about football than people who've been doing this for a living. And I think we've definitely seen in Green Bay, like, this is a consistently good team that makes consistently smart choices. And one of the reasons for that is the lack of meddling from one of these, you know, new age hedge fund owners who thinks that they can apply the same practices that allowed them to, I don't know, tear apart an airlines to rebuild a football team. But from a public perspective, one of the things it also means is that when you put money into the team, the money then goes back into the community. So you're at a game, you buy a beer, you buy a jersey. You know, like in Green Bay, for example, that local charities are going to get supported from that. You know that some of the money is going to be allotted towards things like schools, hospitals, what have you. And the team could in itself become something that's a buoy for a community, something that keeps it afloat and alive, as opposed to something that's more like a millstone around the neck of a community.
Or a parasite.
Yeah, or a parasite. Yeah, dragging it down.
So, I mean, look, I agree with you 100%, and I do think the Green Bay example is actually pretty illustrative of that. I want to move on to another subject that's also near and dear to me, being the NCAA and amateurism. Now, I've written about the idea of an athlete strike. I think you have too, and how that could change the system. A lot of people, including myself, have written about the Ed O'Bannon suit and how that might change the system. And I also think that public opinion is really starting to turn against what's basically economic feudalism in college sports. Now, a couple weeks ago, someone asked me if the federal government might actually get involved with this, maybe with hearings, maybe with actual legislation. I'll be honest, I didn't have a good answer. And that's in part because Congress doesn't really seem to get involved with anything these days beyond failed votes to repeal Obamacare for like the 100th time. But I'm wondering, you're here in D.C. I know you're pretty plugged in. Do you think there's a place for Congress when it comes to the NCAA and amateurism? And if there is, what would that be, and what are the odds they'd actually get involved?
That's a great question. I mean, there's of course a place for, and we've seen this time said rhetorically by members of Congress, that there is a place for them to step in on the NCAA. I mean, for all kinds of reasons, for all kinds of jurisdictional reasons, like not the least of which is the fact that public universities play such a central role in the bowl championship series and in the power conferences. Mm-hmm. So there's
a college football playoff now in
coming years. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And the fact that the NCAA is a nonprofit. Remember, nonprofit status is something that goes through the government.
That's
and
true.
It involves all kinds of tax protections and all kinds of ways in which you're allowed exemptions that allow you to hide money and raise money
That's one of the biggest, if not next to workers not paying workers' comp, that's probably the biggest reason that all these schools cling to amateurism. It's basically a tax dodge.
No, you're right. You're absolutely right. Absolutely right. So if you had crusaders in Congress who wanted to go after this, who wanted to say something like, "Well, wait a minute, you know, you can't use the phrase student athlete as a way to prevent from paying workers' compensation." I mean, that's something that's very real. That's something that could happen.
Do you think that
see Ed O'Bannon using the courts right now? I mean, which is in effect another use of public institutions as a way to find justice here. And so you know, I mean, obviously, you know, there's a lot to happen. It probably would take an imaginary Congress filled with crusaders and justice-minded people, which
right, not people looking to basically just get a revolving door lobbying job after they leave.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so there's a fantastical aspect of saying it, but in the abstract, which really was your question, you know, is there a place for Congress? Then yes, yes, yes. And we have seen in recent years on issues like with the NFL blackout rule, Congress getting involved, making public statements, and doing some of the work to try to have more justice for sports fans.
Well, you know, I mean, the thing about Congress is that a lot of times all they have to do, at least to affect some change, and maybe it's not as much change as you and I might like on particular issues, but to affect some change, all they have to really do is hold hearings, call people on the carpet, and embarrass them. Don't you think?
Absolutely.
Let's move over to football and brain trauma, which is another place where Congress has intervened, where the NFL, for all that I've criticized them, they have at least made changes after Roger Goodell was basically embarrassed in front of Congress. Now, you and I have talked about this overall issue before. I feel like we're on the same page where you've compared the NFL and what's going on with the players to the situation of coal miners and basically said this is a workplace safety matter. I've looked at youth football and I sort of think of it the way I think of cigarettes or alcohol or maybe even lead paint, where you've got a lucrative industrial product that also carries a pretty serious public health cost, and we need to treat it as such. So like both of us kind of look at it as a public health issue and not a political issue. Now, last week, though, there was this pretty publicized article in the Wall Street Journal. It was called In Defense of Football. The author made a bunch of the usual arguments in favor of a sport. You know, he said more people get hurt riding a bike. reforms are making it safer, life involves risk, the game builds character, all that kind of typical stuff that I've often pushed back against. But in this case, it wasn't really what interested me. What interested me was a report in Politico after this piece was published. And the Politico report had an email to the author of the piece, a military historian named Max Boot. The email came from Sam Walker, who is the sports editor of the Wall Street Journal. I want to read you what he wrote. Here's what he said. Another thing you might mention is this absurd concussion lobby, which consists of these researchers in Boston and assorted grant-grubbing academics and worrywarts who are all trying hard to push this nanny state narrative. The quarterback of that team, of course, is the New York Times, but we wouldn't want to mention them in our piece. Sam Walker also wrote in his email to this writer, there isn't any evidence that shows that kids who play up through high school and then stop are any more likely to have lasting health or brain issues. No evidence. Now, something to note. One, the researcher who helped the actual author of the piece looked up a bunch of articles, wrote to the author, and said, you know what? Don't
Yeah,
make that
let's
argument
save
about
that.
no evidence, because there's plenty of evidence, which is kind of ironic. But this really disturbed me, because here you have Sam Walker, you have a guy who is a sports editor of a major national newspaper who doesn't seem to know what he's talking about. He had no idea about the basic facts of what, at least in my opinion, is one of the biggest, if not the biggest, sports stories of the last decade. And on
Well,
top of that, he's
it says,
cramming. You
go
know,
ahead,
he, I
sorry.
know, it's just the thing that made me even more infuriated. It seemed like he was cramming, again, what I think is a public health issue, into this like red state, blue state political frame. He's babbling about the nanny state,
Yeah.
grant grubbing academics, a concussion lobby, and he's complaining about the New York Times. Now, so what I want to ask you is like, do you think this issue, you know, football, brain safety, can become one of those polarized political things like climate change, where science and caution take a back seat to spin and cultural grievances?
It already is.
You think
It,
so?
this exemplified that. It already is. And it's unfortunately, at this point, I think it exists more in the fantastical minds of people like Max Boot. But it's like serious people like Roger Goodell. I don't know what Roger Goodell's politics are, but he gets that this has to be dealt with at the very least on a superficial public relations level. He's not out there saying words like chickified and and we're all becoming a nation of wusses and nanny state and all that stuff that people like Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh. I mean, these guys have been on the yay football bandwagon forever. And to me, it's so similar. And Max Boot being an example of this is such a good example of this, of the people who, cheerled the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and were so blatantly and horrifically wrong about how U.S. troops would be received, et cetera, et cetera. Because what do they all have in common? Is they never, none of these people, Max Boot never had a gun, a helmet, and a uniform and had to go over there. The same way, none of these guys actually have to go out on the field and face Ray Lewis. Now, a lot of people would say, oh, you can't compare football with war. And I've written a million things about what a trite comparison it is. But the fact of the matter is that the NFL is doing joint multi-million-dollar investigations of brain injuries with the U.S. Army because they have found that traumatic brain injury sustained in an IED attack is extremely similar to what you get playing in the National Football League. But these are guys who don't play, they watch. These aren't guys who fight in wars. They just tell other people to fight them. And you get the same kind of logical syllogism at the end of the day, which has everything to do with a kind of macho ethos that's completely disconnected from science and reality. And you see, like you said, you see it with climate change, you see it with this issue as well. And I got to say one thing about the whole plagiarism issue, because I actually don't believe that Max Boot plagiarized the other gentleman after reading
What?
both columns, after studying it. I don't think
You
it's
know, let's
plagiarism.
explain real quick to people who are listening. You know, basically what Dave's talking about is that the idea for this In Defense of Football column was pitched to the Wall Street Journal by another writer named Daniel Flynn, who actually has a book about this. The journal turned him down, and then shortly thereafter, they reached out to this guy, Max Boot, a military historian, and asked him to write basically the same thing. So that's where the plagiarism accusation comes from. But Dave, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think what the I mean I, after reading it over very closely, I think what the Washington what the Wall Street Journal editorial staff did, what their editor did, was incredibly sketchy and unprincipled. Like, somebody pitches an idea to you, you think it's great, but you want one of your big name people to do it, so you shuttle it off to him and give the other person to boot. That's a very scuzzy practice, but it's not plagiarism. It's not the same thing as plagiarism. But the articles are similar in terms of how they're laid out. Why don't I think it's plagiarism? Because I think the argument itself, Patrick, is so trite and so narrow that there's really only one way to make it.
Right. So it's Patrick, basically, what else are they going to say?
Yeah, what else are they going to say? Like, Patrick, if you wrote an article tomorrow about the effect of concussions, and I wrote an article tomorrow about the effect of concussions, they might have some similar stats, but they would be very different articles because there's so many different ways to look at this issue on the merits of the facts. But when you're writing a, well, we're becoming a chickified culture, it's much safer to play football than leave your house, which is actually something Max Boot wrote, and there are only so many ways to say that. It would be like if Sean Hannity accused Rush Limbaugh of plagiarism and Rush Limbaugh accused Sean Hannity of plagiarism. I mean, they're saying the same crap every
right.
day.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And like I said, to me, it's just the fact that a major sports editor just didn't have any basic knowledge about this issue. Again, you can have the knowledge of what we know right now about the risk of football, and you can make an argument defending the sport. You can make a good faith argument. I might disagree with you. A sure. lot of people might disagree with you, but like, I'll listen to you and we'll debate. But sure. to just be ignorant that there's any sort of health risk and say there's no evidence, it makes me think like, you're a sports editor of a major national newspaper. What do you do all day? What are you reading?
Exactly.
Like, what are you paying attention to? To me, it was like, it bordered on, never mind the plagiarism stuff, that to me, that just bordered on journalism malpractice.
Yeah.
I'm dumbfounded by that. But yeah. I don't want to keep on this forever. Let me get out here with one last question, which does relate to this issue, football and brain trauma. Late last week, we saw ESPN drop out of its partnership with PBS's Frontline. They were working on that documentary about the NFL's handling of concussions and brain trauma. It's called League of Denial. PBS recently screened a trailer, and you know, from the title alone, you can guess it was not flattering to the NFL. Now, personally, I'm not surprised. A lot of very unflattering things have already been written and reported about how the NFL did and did not deal with this problem. I've been one of the people doing a lot of that writing. And presumably ESPN wasn't surprised either, because they've been working with Frontline for 14 months on this, and they've published a number of joint stories already. And the two guys that are at the core of this documentary, the two reporters who are also publishing a book of the same title, they're ESPN reporters. It's Steve Ferenew and Mark Ferenewada. So last week when the New York Times reported that the NFL is actually the one that pressured ESPN to drop their name from this project, I could believe it, but I was still confused. Because I felt like ESPN knew this was coming, but I also felt like the NFL knew this was coming for a long time. I'm sure they did. They monitor all this stuff. So I really don't understand why they would do this now, why they would actually give this film and book even more publicity, maybe even more credibility. This is the stuff the NFL doesn't want you to hear. I really can't get my head around it. Now, I know that you wrote about this today for The Nation.
Yeah.
And you talked to some ESPN people off the record, and they had some pretty incendiary things to say. But
yeah.
Let me ask you the bigger question. What do you think is really going on here? You know, why do you think this happened? And let me even ask you, maybe you can draw some parallels with corporate pressure on the news media from politics or outside of sports that might give us some insight into how something like this goes down.
Yeah, Patrick, I mean, why it happened? I mean, I talked to very smart people at ESPN, and they're completely confused. They think there's something else going on in the story. They're even people who say, you know what, this is how ESPN operates. This is how it always operates. Business always wins when it's against journalism. They're shocked by the specifics of this process, like the fact that it took 15 months to do it. They're kind of shocked because it speaks to almost a panicked level of disorganization, which is the last thing you associate with ESPN.
Or with the NFL.
Or with the NFL, yeah, or with the NFL for that matter. So all of that is pretty stunning, top to bottom. And so several people said, we're going to hear something else about this coming up. Maybe there's something in the documentary that nobody knew or the Fenarus knew. and no one, you know, and it just, when people found out it was going to be there, they flipped and overreacted. That to me is at least the theory that's the least conspiratorial and it makes the most sense.
Right.
There was almost like a holy shit kind of a thing.
We might have to beep that out, by the way. I don't know. I think we have the tools for that, but go on.
Holy crap. That's the only thing that actually makes sense to me, is that there was some sloppiness. And frankly, that this is so ironic, but that the wall was working. And you know what I mean when I say the wall.
Right, the wall at ESPN between the business side, that it has contracts with all, and it has partners with all these leagues that they broadcast, and the journalism side, where you're covering them as journalists. Look, I worked at ESPN, so I understand that. And there's always been that inherent tension at ESPN, and there always will be. And, you know, the business side of the wall is what makes all the money. The journalism side of the wall is sort of like the prestige product to go with it, the loss leader in a way.
That's what makes this so interesting, though, because maybe the wall was working. Maybe if the Fenarus were working on this, they were digging stuff up. They were in the weeds with PBS putting this together, and the word finally got out. And there was, instead of the response that it should have been, which, I mean, obviously what you said before in this interview was so right on. It's like ESPN is just making more people want to watch this. Like, it's possible it could have come and gone with
frankly
minimal notice.
And the weird thing to me is, so is the NFL. If the NFL, as the New York Times reported, and the NFL has denied, if they were actually pressuring ESPN or even Disney, and whatever level this pressure is going on, and my guess with the NFL, it's probably going on at every level. They're extremely PR savvy. They've been that way for decades. You know, you don't really mess with the NFL. They're the best at all of this. They're the best at spin. They're better than any politician I've ever seen here in Washington.
Right.
It just seems to me almost clumsy. Like, why do it now? Like, why not get involved before ESPN and PBS ever partnered? When, what did they really expect? I mean, those brothers are serious journalists. Frontline is serious investigative journalism. They're not going to serve up softballs. You know what I mean? Like, and the other thing that's crazy, like I said, the stuff that was in that trailer, it's stuff that's been out there. It's stuff that's been reported. It's been reported by myself. It's been reported by the New York Times. It's been reported by ESPN. ESPN's done some good work on this. Peter Keating of ESPN, the magazine, back in 2006, his article about Elliot Pelman, the Jets doctor, mm-hmm. who was head of the NFL concussion committee and like the lead of all this denialism and, you know, science, you know, discrediting and sending guys out in the same game with concussions. I mean, Peter Keating was the guy that broke that story. If you look at the actual lawsuits against the NFL, his story is a huge like source for so many of the things that are claimed in that lawsuit. So it's not like the NFL and ESPN didn't know this was coming.
Yeah.
It's crazy to me. And maybe they have some sort of incredible smoking gun that we don't know about yet. I'm eager to find out.
Yeah, and once again, we're all eager to find out, which is one of the results of this.
Right, right. Well, look, Dave, we've gone over time and we're running out here, but it's been great having you. Before we sign off, tell everybody where they can find you on Twitter.
Oh, at Edge of Sports.
Please. At Edge of Sports.
Come on through.
All right. That's Dave Zirin. That's going to do it for us for now. Really good podcast. I enjoyed it. Definitely have to have it on you soon. Have you on again soon. Excuse me. But for now, for Sports on Earth, I'm Patrick Ruby, saying goodbye, Ruby Tuesday.